Dear Ajahn, halfway through my meditation, I suddenly noticed that my body is so comfortable and totally free from all pain. It was a very pleasant feeling. Could Ajahn Khan explain what is actually happening? Yes. Oh, I'll carry on. Then my breathing also was very calm and subtle. It was so easy to follow. I've been following the breathing for some time, and I wonder I should continue to follow it patiently, or should I arouse some positive energy? I noticed it was lack of joy and quite plain. Could Ajahn suggest ways to increase, mental energy, sadhana? Why is it that when people get lovely experiences like that, they want more? It's lovely, you had a great time there. You're totally so comfortable and totally free from all pain. In Pali, that's called kaya prasadi, the tranquility and comfort of the body. It's a natural stage in the meditation. You're sitting here and just no pain, no discomfort at all. You think you can sit for hours, and sometimes you do feel sit for hours. Because what's happening here, that so much of the pain and tension in the body is the mind doing it. If you get the mind out of the way, the body really relaxes and it feels really comfortable. Remember what I said yesterday about the mental arrow, the mental part of any pain is 99%, or maybe 95% I said yesterday. And the rest of it, you know, the physical pain, is actually very small indeed. And when you actually start to really relax the mind, and the mind is peaceful, the body, that 5% sometimes, that's maximum, and sometimes even that 5% you can't feel, which is why the person there felt just so comfortable and totally free from all pain, just sitting there absolutely comfortable. And I know this myself, there's no such comfortable position you could ever have in life than when you get into that beautiful, peaceful state. It's the only time your body doesn't sort of itch, ache, ask for things. It's totally at peace and comfortable. So that's a beautiful state to get into. And of course, what happens next is because it's very pleasant and free from pain, there's nothing going on in the body. If you just stay there, the body disappears. It has to, because the body's not any problem anymore. So it's nothing to keep you on the body, so it just goes. And your breathing was also very calm and subtle, so easy to follow, of course. Now you've been following the breathing for some time, and I wonder, should I continue to follow it? That was your mistake. Get out of the way. Stop worrying about what you're supposed to be doing next. You lost present moment awareness. You think, what should I do next? And a bit of doubt came in. Just carry on enjoying it. So the trouble is with, you know, human beings, they always want something more. And it's that wanting something more is a problem all the time. So learn contentment. You lost contentment there. You're doing a wonderful job there. Get into beautiful states of meditation, but don't lose your contentment. Oh, this is good enough. Oh, this is really good enough. Oh, this will do me for the whole retreat. And then if you have that, no expectations, you're totally content with this beautiful state, then the positive energy comes up. It's wanting something more is the negative energy. It's, you know, thinking, what should I do next to get more, is the negative energy. One of the sayings I said at the beginning, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And when you don't enjoy what you already have, that's why the meditation doesn't go on. So, you did really well, but you slipped up for the last. So next time, don't wonder about anything. Just give the keys of the car to your mind, and you just be the passenger. You don't do anything at all. Or sometimes what I used to do, I'd imagine myself, use a car simile, and I'd take my hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedal, in busy traffic. Let go. You see, you're afraid. You think, well, if I don't do anything, meditation's going to crash. When you do something, it crashes. Not the other way around. So you just imagine that simile, take your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, and you find that just the breath just gets calmer and calmer, disappears, and you get heaps of happiness. So is that quite clear what to do? Next time, just don't do anything. Dear Ajahn Brahm, why there is two samadhis? One is better with lots of energy and the other is not. What causes makes these two different effects? I think what they're talking about is, you know, that sort of samadhi which is dull. Okay, you're still, but you've got no oomph and energy because you haven't really gone on the right path into the sort of the meditation. You know, you're not really still enough. You're just going off into this sort of dull state, and it's, you know, it's usually a sort of a dead end. You can't really take it any further. So just have a bit more mindfulness so that when you're going along that path, you will notice there is a fork in the road. One path leads to dullness, the other one, it keeps the mindfulness going. And either you can do that programming mindfulness, or you can just develop in your general daily life the perception of the beautiful. You know, just beautiful trees and the flowers and the floor and the monk and the nuns, beautiful nuns, bhikkhunis. You know, beautiful everything in this place, beautiful view, beautiful tea, beautiful rain. So when you look out for that joy and beauty, you develop that, then you don't get so bored and dull. Now, there are some people in this world that just no matter whatever happens, the other people, I think they've got, what is it, cable TV, 30 channels, nothing on it. They go from one to another and they can't find anything to interest them. And you know, apparently there's people pay millions and millions of dollars just for one sort of, you know, movie or one sort of segment on that TV. And you find it boring. Gee, I mean, what can interest you if you haven't got 30 channels? I remember when I was a kid, we had two channels. Was it ITV and BBC in UK? And sometimes there was fights to the death on who would get the channel on. So I don't know what, wasn't really to the death, but we'd argue as kids. I don't know what, you know, what it's like with 30 channels. Actually, I know what it's like. Now, you all have your own TV, so you don't really argue with anybody. We only had one TV for the whole family. So, but anyway, sort of the one with lots of energy is the one which is because you've had that sort of positive thinking. And you're a good person, and you find joy in things, and you delight in things. So if you want to develop that positive energy, as I said a few days ago, just remember all your generosity. And if you haven't got any generosity, there's a donation box in the dana hall. So put some in and then remember it. Oh, what a wonderful thing I've done. Remember all your precepts. And if you haven't kept precepts very well on this retreat, you've still got another couple of days to get your act together. Now remember your restraint about sort of not speaking and just the fact you're meditating here. Wonderful thing to do, so remember all of that until you feel really good about yourself. And that gives you joy and that gives you energy. And this is called Chaganusati, Silanusati. These are two of the 40 meditation reflections the Buddha taught. Remembering your generosity and all the wonderful things you've done. Remember other people's generosity. You know, this is a $5 million center. And many, many people just gave, you know, $10, $5, sometimes, you know, a lot more than that. And all the people who just came here to make it possible for you to come and meditate. Why doesn't that inspire you? And then they say even the monks, you know, lay, I don't know, two-thirds of this floor, up to 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And actually the floor you're sitting on this side over here, was all laid by monks. In 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. So doesn't that inspire you? Wow. When that starts to inspire you, then you get your energies. So it's up to you to develop inspiration. If it's not inspiration in your own goodness and your own wonderful qualities, inspiration in others' qualities. And that takes you out of the dullness and makes it alive and beautiful. Because one of the problems in 9-day retreats is sometimes you need to be inspired a bit more. You know, you can't sort of give a talk sort of, you know, every couple of hours, although some of you probably would like that. You know, you just, morning and evening is enough and a few interviews during the middle of the day. But you have to start developing your own energy. And inspiration is one of the greatest ways. But once it gets going, once your meditation really does start taking off, you get the natural energy, you don't have to worry anymore. You always get the beautiful states. The next, when you come out of jhanas, how long you have that pure mind. It really, well, go into jhanas first of all and find out for yourself. But it's, you know, the power of that jhana and the sort of the depth of it, you know, that will sort of knock out the five hindrances. They've just got this punch and they've knocked out like a boxer in a ring. Depends how hard the punch was, how long you stay unconscious. So it really depends on how much letting go there was, how much power, how much bliss. For the hindrances to disappear. But it's usually a long time. And get to know, associate, be at ease. Once you can be at ease with jhana, can you get into a jhana any time you wanted to? It's naturally, those states of recognition, familiarity and ease, they really only apply to the things before the jhanas. Because in the jhanas there is no stages, it's just jhana, 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 jhana. But really what you need to do is to have the recognition, familiarity and ease with the states before jhanas. That makes it much easier to get into a jhana. So the recognition of what actually is sort of present moment awareness, what silence, what is the breath, what is the full awareness of the breath, what is the delightful breath, what is it like when the delightful breath and all the body disappears, what's it like when the nimitta comes up, what's it like when the nimitta becomes stable and brilliant, and what's it like falling into that nimitta. So those are the stages which you recognize, familiar with and at ease with. Because in the jhana, there's choices and will just don't have any option. So those stages only apply outside of a jhana. And actually, when you say, can you get into a jhana any time you want it to? Any time you want it, you can't get in. That's the right answer. I went to Thailand a few years ago and happened to meet a monk in his mid-40s. He is kind, gentle, smart, charismatic and attentive. My heart couldn't help but completely got smitten by him. He's too charming. Because of this feeling, I had ever developed a sex fantasy with him. I felt so sinful. Had I developed a bad karma, what should I do? Sorry, Ajahn, to ask this question. Thank you for your help. No, just mental karma is very small. So, you were just a girl. And it's really, when a monk is in his young age, his 30s or 40s, just the purity and the charisma can be quite attractive to monks. I remember one of the monks I grew up with, he was giving a retreat, I think, in England. And it was only like, those days, they didn't have beautiful halls like this, just a small place. And so, there was one woman was sitting right in front of him. It's nothing to do with you, Dunya. Right in front of him every day. And obviously, there's a reason why she was sitting in front of him. And one day, there was a note on his seat. So, he thought it might be some sort of question about meditation. And he read it, and it says, I've fallen in love with you. Will you run away with me and marry me? So it does happen to monks sometimes. So, we just laugh about such things. So, it's natural. It happens when people have fantasies. And it's the same type of fantasy that sometimes people, like women, have like to prisoners on death row and things. No, it's true, because it's like, it's a safe fantasy because it will never happen. And it's just a psychology of, that you feel like free to fantasize and dream because there's no danger of it actually happening. So sometimes there is that psychology of like a monk or a person in death row or men towards nuns simply because it's unattainable. So now it's natural. So what do you do when you have a thought like that and you feel guilty about it? You just acknowledge, forgive and learn. AFL code again. Yeah, you had a fantasy about a monk. So, acknowledge it, so don't hide it, and just forgive it. It's natural because you're not fully enlightened yet. It will happen. And then you learn from it. And it's just stupid. One of the monks, I won't tell you what his name is, but he told me he was in this monastery once, and every evening they do a 2-hour meditation. And sometimes it was really hot and lots of mosquitoes and this time he was really tired and didn't know really what to do. So, he sort of started thinking about sex. Now I'm bringing it up now. So he said the 2 hours were the fastest 2 hours he'd ever sat in meditation. He didn't feel any pain in his body at all because he was totally obsessed with no fantasy. And the end of the meditation, he came out and he thought, what have I done? Because he had a teacher, one of these teachers, who could read your mind. He knew he could read his mind. And he felt very, very scared when the teacher came up to him. Oh my God, what's he going to say? He's known what I've been thinking about. And the teacher came up and just gave this wonderful, like, one-line dharma. He said, you've just been wasting your time. That's all. So it wasn't sort of like, you bad monk, you've been thinking about sex. It was actually, with like forgiveness, but understanding what the real problem was. You're just wasting time. So all those sexual fantasies about monks or nuns or whatever, you don't feel bad about it. You just, all you've done is you've wasted your time. When you're on this retreat, you should be sort of meditating, not doing that stuff. So remember, it's just a waste of time. Remember that. It's good teaching. For those of us who fail to become enlightened in this retreat, you still got 2 or 3 days left yet. Talk about going for the future. If you think you're going to fail to become enlightened, then of course you will fail. So shut up and just see what happens. Can you please explain the benefits of letting go to keep us happy until we reach the big E? Of course. I mean, the more you can let go of the pain of the past and the worries and fears about the future, you can be happier and happier. Now is the time your future is being made. And letting go of past and future means you put more attention into the coal face of your life, the place which really matters, the place where you can really do something about your future health, happiness and peace, right now. So by letting go of the past and the future, you actually become a much more successful, healthier, happier human being. Because you're putting your attention where the action of life is, rather than just being in cuckoo land, thinking about sex, thinking about movies, thinking about football, thinking about what you're going to do when you go home, remembering all the terrible things which have happened to you so far in your life. It means you're not here. So you can't do anything to really do something about your future. So if you really let go of those two things, you're a huge way ahead in life. If you can just let go of all this thinking, then maybe you can hear something. The story I haven't told, which I usually tell every retreat, is the six Thai ladies who were cooking the meal at Bodhinyana Monastery for the monks that day. Six ladies were in the kitchen. I just happened to go past that kitchen and look through the window. There's only six women in that kitchen, and all six of them had their mouth open talking. And I started thinking, my insight was this: if six people are doing the talking, who's doing the listening? No one was doing the listening. Just what a waste of time all that talking was. And if someone's talking, you need someone to do the listening. So it's just our life. We talk so much inside our head. We hardly ever do the listening to the words of life, to the teachings of nature. So if you could just let go of that inner commentary more, you'll hear so much more about life, nature, and yourself. You become far more sensitive as a human being. You're not talking back at life. You're listening to life more, feeling it, knowing it, instead of talking back all the time. Just doing that much, huge advantage in life. So any relationships, you're far more sensitive. You can figure out what's going on because you listen more. Can you please advise on how to practice Maranasati and Asupanasati during retreat and at home? With thanks. Maranasati is recollection of your death. When you go, well look, this is how to do it. There's maybe 65 people in this room because there's people from over the monastery. And according to statistics, I think 1.5 of you will be dead by this time next year. Which ones will it be? And don't just look at the old people in the back. I could almost guarantee one of you will be dead by this time next year. Which one is it going to be? Any volunteers? Maybe two people put their hand up. Remember, but you're very clever, because if you want it to happen, no way would it happen. Just like jhanas. So what Maranasati is, you go to bed tonight, you don't know if you're going to wake up. Many people die in bed. In fact, it's the most dangerous place on earth. Remember that, so don't go to bed tonight. So what Narada Sati is, look, your time is running out. For me, the last 2, 3, 4 years have gone so quickly. I'm 58 already. I haven't got long to go. How much have you got to go? 5, 10, 15 years? That's so fast. You know, I'm well over halfway. Many of you, that's why they say we're over the hill. Each one of us is over the hill. I think everyone probably. So knowing that's all what death is. And death is beautiful because all of your problems, have you got many problems? All those problems disappear at death. No husband, no wife, no kids' problems, no money problems. Oh, you're so free. No monastery problems. I can give that to Bamali and Apichato, they can look after that. So you're totally free at death. So death is a beautiful thing. It's the greatest way of letting go of all your problems and concerns. So, Marana Sati is just remembering that death is going to happen any time, and what a beautiful thing it is. Beautiful way of letting go, and you've got nothing to fear, and it's great. And Asupa Sati during retreat and home, that's just, I don't recommend Asupa Sati to most of you, because most Westerners are already pretty depressed. And if you start looking at the sort of the disgusting nature, say, of food, this is how I used to do it when I was in Thailand. It was actually disgusting food anyway, it's pretty easy to do. But you look at your food, you know, maybe you had something nice to eat, like sort of a cake or something. And you look at that food and that piece of cake, that small cake, and I think, I'm going to eat that cake soon. It's going to go through my stomach, through my guts. When it comes out the other end, it's a piece of shit. Now, where did that piece of shit come from? It's in that cake somewhere. Because it's in that cake. It doesn't come from outside. So that cake I was eating, there was shit in there somewhere. And on the outside, or somewhere, it was covered up with, you know, the proteins and nutrients which I would actually absorb. But the rest of it, and most of it, you know, comes out. You know, you only absorb a tiny fraction. Maybe it's 80% shit. And I looked at that, and I didn't want to eat it. So that's my way of doing it. Super. So when you eat your food tomorrow, or your breakfast, you look at that and it says, where is that shit? It's in there somewhere. It's got to be. Reason. Because, you know, shit doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from what you put in your mouth. And so you separate some of it out, and what's left is the feces. So if you're really into food, that's a great way of losing your appetite. And of course the other thing, which is one of the reasons why, especially monks and nuns do a super, because we're celibate, and sometimes you see this really beautiful girl come in. I know when I was a young monk, you know, when you got young, you got lots of lust, you see this beautiful girl come in, so what do you do? Well, I used to do, and I taught this to my young monks, I always look for her pimples. She always had one somewhere. And that's what I used to do. And what's the pimple? And it wasn't good enough now. It's just a flaw in the product. So I didn't want to take it anymore. But I noticed that when you have lust, you don't do that. You don't look for the faults. You look for, you know, her beautiful hair or a bosom or something. Whatever, you know, really turns you on, you know, the attractive part, if you have lust, that's what you go for. So to balance that, I deliberately went for the things which would turn me off. And that's like a super. And all it was doing, it wasn't sort of, you know, trying to denigrate sort of women or sort of think that, you know, they were terrible or they were menaces to monastic life or anything like that. No, we don't take it that far. It's just so you can get a balance. You know, that for a man, a woman is a human being. It's not a sex figure. You know, it's a person to be respected as a being. Not take away the male-female thing, and it makes life so much more simple. So that's why even here, in some retreats, men on one side, women on the other side. And now you're all mixed up because you're yogis, you know, you've taken 8 precepts, so it doesn't matter where you sit. And even just the way you dress, you know. A lot of times I notice that when a person grows up to maybe about 8, 9, or 10, they look pretty much the same. And then they go through the puberty, and that's where men and women sort of separate out. And when they get old, again, they look the same again. They do. So it's only that, you know, the gender difference is only a little sort of time. You know, the girl, they all get the flat breasts. And just, you know, even their faces, they look pretty much the same as men. If it wasn't for the hair, and these days, you know, men have long hair, women have short hair. So sometimes you can't tell the difference. It wasn't for the clothes and other stuff, which actually is just your side of difference. Basically, there is no difference in those ages. So you know, I kind of like that because you know, it takes away all this problem of you know, sex and gender and stuff like that, where we recognize what we have in common. So that's how we do a super anyway. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please talk more on this very tantalizing area of no will? At what point are we responsible for our own actions if we are will beyond our knowledge and awareness? This is a serious question. Yeah, it's now responsibility still happens. So just because, you know, you think, well, I hadn't got any choice in this. My choice was, choice is real, it's just it's not coming from you. So because there is choice, there are some repercussions of what you do. So, you know, there is repercussions. If you go and sort of, you know, kill me, and then when you go to court, you say, no, Ajahn Brahm said there's no will. So it wasn't me who did it, judge. You still go to jail. So there is repercussions there. It's karma. So you are responsible for your actions. So when you make a choice, it's not really you making it, but you see there's a choice being made, and you know that whichever way you go will have a consequence. And it's that remembering the consequences of actions will actually influence the will. So that's actually how the will happens. That's what it really is. It's responding to your conditioning, you know, just how you've willed before, but also to this thing inside of us, which again is not yours, memory, and sort of wisdom, which will show you that, you know, this one is going to lead to problems, this one is not going to lead to problems. And that is going to condition your will to go in this direction rather than that direction. So responsibility is also there. It is a fascinating subject. But really, first of all, you've got to find out what the will is to really understand this. When I mentioned this, it was just giving you an idea of what's going to happen. Just to blow your mind a bit and see what enlightenment truly is and what insight truly is. But you know, you can't understand it fully, and it is going to really be tantalizing, and it's also going to be almost inexplainable. But it's tantalizing because you know there's enough evidence to know that this sounds actually something true. You know it from psychology, you know it from that experiment on hypnotism, and you probably know it from your own life as well. Many, many times you think you chose, but it's automatic. Sometimes you'll be doing walking meditation, and sometimes you get so calm in the walking meditation, you're not walking anymore. The body's walking, and it's just like you're just sitting in your body, just watching yourself walk. Even soldiers, when they used to do these marches, they would sometimes march all night, and the psychologists knew that they'd fallen asleep. They were fast asleep, but they were still marching in formation. The body can do this. It's not you choosing. It just does it by itself. And that's fascinating to see. So this idea about will you get enough information, you know it's true, and if you have any confidence and faith in the Buddha's teachings, you know he said that time and time again. Sankhara anatta, the will, which is the main part of the fourth kanda, sankhara, is not self. It's really clear in the teachings of the Buddha. If the will is not myself, then who's doing this? Just a process, that's all. Conditioned. And responsibility is part of that process. But don't think too much about it. Just get into jhana and see it for yourself. Become a frog, not a tadpole. Thank you for taking the time, your compassion and patience to help us along the path. Perhaps like us, you had no choice. Oops, ha ha ha. Yeah, of course I had no choice. And it's wonderful you have no choice in things, that you don't get upset. You know, you don't think, oh, why do I have to keep answering these same old questions again? Oh, why do I have to have these interviews? Oh, why do I have to always give these talks? It's not fair. Well, you could, now you've got no choice. It makes life much easier. You stop complaining. Oh yeah, I've never actually said about one of the famous similes of the driverless bus. You know, many of you know that simile, but it's a great simile about will. And, you know, maybe it just comes in here. Like, what life is? Life is a bus journey. That's an old simile, like life is a journey. A bus journey. The trouble with life is, though, that on your bus journey, sometimes you go through terrible scenery. You go through what I call the toxic waste dumps of life. And it's so painful and so unpleasant that you want to get out as fast as you possibly can. So that simile to the bus driver just going through this terrible scenery. And you tell the bus driver, hurry out of here, get out of here, this is terrible, I want to sort of get out as soon as possible. The trouble is your bus driver doesn't follow orders. Sometimes in the worst parts of your life it slows down and lasts longer than it should do. But then other times in your life you're having just a wonderful, beautiful time. It's like your bus is going through the wonderful scenery. And you ask the bus driver, can you slow down please? I really want to enjoy this wonderful scenery I'm looking at through the window. And the bus driver slams his foot on the accelerator. And sometimes your beautiful experiences, your pleasures, your happy times, they don't last as long as they should. And that's life. You get too much pain and difficulty and it lasts for far too long. And the happiness and delight, they don't last as long as they should. So sometimes people come to meditation or they come to any part of spiritual life and they want to teach their bus driver how to slow down when it's pleasurable and how to get out quicker when it's painful. Find strategies of getting out of suffering as fast as possible and other strategies to have more delight and pleasure. But to be able to do that, to get some more control over your happiness and suffering, which is what most of you are here for, you want to find out this will, this bus driver. So you can teach him or her or it a lesson. Bus driver, this is what you should do. Will, I'm going to teach you some wisdom, Will. So whenever we have some beautiful time, Will, you're the driver, slow down when I'm in pleasurable time. When I'm in suffering, Will, you get wiser, so get me out of this, this hole as quick as possible. So a lot of times we do everything with wisdom because we want to instruct Will to be smarter and have less pain and suffering in life. But to be able to instruct the will, you've got to find it first of all. So back to the simile of the bus, you're sitting down there, you've got to find the bus driver's seat where your will lives. So you can teach will to be smarter instead of making all these mistakes. It's your will's fault making all these mistakes. So you've got to teach will a lesson. You've got to find it first of all before you teach it a lesson. So you get up off your seat and you walk down the bus to the bus driver's seat. And that's the time when you get one of the great insights of your spiritual life. You find the bus driver's seat is empty. No one's in there. Non-self. Once you see the bus driver's seat is empty, the thing which drives you and your whole life, what do? You just go back to your seat and stop complaining. There's no one to shout at anymore. And that's wonderful. Stop complaining. No more desire and ill will. You find the bus driver's seat. No one there. So, you mentioned this morning that the people who experience NDEs also get to see the limiter, like practitioners going through the jhanas. Is it possible for people to do astral travelling via out-of-body experience? If yes, do they also see the limiters? Thank you. Actually, the people who do the astral travelling, they don't see limiters because they've still got the five senses in a more refined sense is happening. That's why the astral travelling, and it's got a name in Buddhism. The Buddha recognized that as a real phenomenon. He called it the manomayakaya, the mind-made body, but it's still got senses. Therefore, you don't see limiters yet. But those people who have NDEs, when they float out of the body, they can see what's going on, they can hear things, and then they go to the limiter. And once they go to the limiter, they can't see and hear things anymore, at least not sort of this plane. So NDEs, when you go out of the body experiences, that's one thing, it's not limiter yet. Dear Ajahn, when suffering fades away, it's happiness. Is that happiness of meditation, of sign of the mind, something that was there but not noticed, or is that happiness of freedom and relief when the thing disappears, a Vedana arises? It is puzzling to understand in a framework what the bliss in meditation is. More importantly, Nibbana is the ultimate happiness because existence ceases. Please explain that. Another way of putting it, when suffering gradually fades, existence and self are fading and it's peaceful, but what is that peace? Okay, now that's a bit complicated. Could you please keep questions simple? There's too many there. So first of all, the happiness of meditation, a sign of the mind. Happiness of meditation is a sign of stillness. So when you're really still, and the stillness is there for a long time, happiness comes up. It's mental energy. The happiness of freedom and relief when a thing disappears, yes, when suffering ceases, and that's happiness. And so a lot of times when the past and the future disappears, you feel free. It's just the same way as a person who's been carrying their suitcases around all day, you put them down, I'm free. And that's the happiness, or as Ajahn Chah used to put it, it's like a person who is born with a rope around their neck, pulled tight by two demons, desire and ill will. And those desire and ill will have been putting that rope tight all your life. You always want something or you don't want something. And that's why you can hardly breathe. And you do this meditation, and those two demons, desire and ill will, they take a break and let go of the rope. No desire, no ill will. I can breathe. That happiness of having no constrictions of desire and ill will. That's also the happiness of contentment. So these are happinesses born of things disappearing, of things being let go of. It's different than the happiness in the world. It's happiness when your football team wins the grand final. Your happiness when you get a check, you know, from the lottery. You're happy when sort of, you know, you have a beautiful meal. Happy with a friend. That's the happiness of getting something. And the happiness of letting things go is the beautiful type. The happiness of freedom. And Nibbana is the ultimate happiness because everything you've given up. Nothing left at all. When suffering gradually fades, existence and selves are fading, and it's peaceful, but is that peace? Of course it's peace. The more things disappear, the more peaceful it is. So fading away is peace, and the highest peace, the greatest bliss, when nothing is left. No. I've got too many questions already. What is the best way to overcome if the same or similar thoughts keep coming after meditation, giving metta or seeing them as they are? Thoughts about my ex keep coming up and they're similar stuff over and over and over again. It means he's not your ex. You're still thinking about him. If it really is your ex, make it your ex. Total ex. So you don't even think about him, because as soon as he keeps coming up, he's not your ex anymore, is he? He's still there, bothering you. And they're similar stuff so over and over again. I really got sick and tired of them, but they just keep coming up to disturb my meditation. Please help. Getting sick and tired of them again is feeding them. So don't get sick and tired of them. Don't give them any attention whatsoever. Just like a person who's knocking at the door of your home trying to sell you something. If you open the door and say, I'm sick and tired of you, then they will just keep on knocking. But if you just ignore them totally, so, you know, they don't even listen to the knocks, then eventually they'll give up. Just like somebody calls you. If you keep answering the telephone, they know you're there. But if you let the telephone ring, 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 they think you're not there anymore. So they give you a bit of peace. So all those thoughts, they're trying to knock on the door of your mind, and you're just shouting at them, no one's home, get out of here. And of course they know you're home. So I remember just ringing up one of our disciples once, and I asked, you know, is Chris at home? And said, hold on a minute, said a 5-year-old daughter, Mummy, are you home? And I could hear them. Who is it? Ajahn Mok. Yeah, yeah, of course. So that's like saying, you know, these thoughts, I'm not at home. They hear you, and they keep coming. So all those thoughts, just ignore them, they're not important. Give value to something else, then the thoughts don't really come. What your mind finds value in will stay there. where your mind doesn't find value in, will disappear. So those things, those thoughts about your ex, you know, you really think they're still important. You think there's some business there to do. There's something to find out or something to do. That's why they keep coming up. So you take away their importance. They're just total rubbish. No value at all. Put your mind on something else. While looking through my room window, this mental arising came to my mind. One day this beautiful meditation center will crumble to dust. Ajahn Brahm's name will be no more. Of course, long, long, long before that, Ajahn Brahm's consciousness would be like the flight path taken by a bird that flew in the sky. This was immediately followed by another mental arising, which was emotional. Why are we chasing behind this pile of dust? Thanks. Indeed. So don't chase anything. Much better. And that's actually the simile of like an enlightened being, like a bird which flies through the air with no trace. So leaving no footprints, no possessions, nothing. As soon as the thing arises, it passes away again, leaving no trace. That's real emptiness. Here we go. If our will does not in reality control our actions, what about the will I'm using to program my mind to be at peace with whatever comes up? To be kind and gentle with it and patient. Is this the same will that I think is controlling my actions or some other part of the mind? Look, I put that in you. So you know, whenever you make peace, be kind, be gentle, be patient, you know where that comes from. You mean my will, yeah. I brainwashed you. So I'm doing that all the time. I admit it. In the same way that you brainwash your partner brainwashes you, the government, the TV, everything brainwashes you. So you admit it. So now you know it's there. Brainwash yourself in beautiful ways. I am good. I am happy. I am deserving of meditation. Brainwash yourself. I can get jhana. Remember, look at me. You can get... If you hadn't have laughed, it would have worked. And then the thought comes out, yeah, I can get jhana. Why do you think you give all these talks? Why do you think motivation works? You know, because you get confident. You see this guy coming up there who you think, you know, knows what he's talking about and so, you know, he's got reputation as a teacher and you believe me. And that's really important because that means that you can do things. You have confidence. And all you need is the confidence, I can do this, and it happens. So I am brainwashing. So all this stuff, even the thing you asked about this will, is because of the talk I gave the other night. So it's amazing, just all of these thoughts are coming from your talk. The reason I talk like this is because Ajahn Chah talked like that. The reason Ajahn Chah talked like that is because Ajahn Mun talked like that. And the buck stops at the Buddha. That's why I teach like that. You know, my teachers were brainwashed. The brainwashing goes all the way down the line. And now it's going out to you. You're brainwashed by the Buddha. And what a wonderful privilege that is. How does seeing the Dhamma lead to seeing dependent origination? What is dependent origination? It's just a process. It's just explaining how the process works. In particular, this dependent origination was meant to explain how you can get reborn, how reincarnation works without a soul, without something to be reborn. And it all shows about the process of things, how the process works, how will works. That's sankhara, the second factor of the dependent origination. How all these things actually work together, how they move together, because keep it simple, simple simile. Suppose you want to go to... So where do you want to go? Say to Paris. The only way you'll get to Paris is to have two things. Number one, you want to get to Paris, the will, and you've got the means to get to Paris. You know, the karmic wherewithal. If you've only got one of those, you want to go to Paris, but you haven't got the money, you haven't got the karma to get there. Or you've got the karma to get there, you're very wealthy, but you don't want to go there, then you never reach there. So how do you get reborn? You have to have the karmic wherewithal, and you want to go there. And if you have enough good karma, and you want to be reborn as a dog, you will be. Some people here in Perth told me that in the next life they want to be a dog. I said, why? See, because dogs, they lie around the house all day. They don't have to go to work in the morning. So they don't even have to cook. They get all this beautiful food. And you know how you treat dogs these days. You know, if the dog don't like that, you go and get it something else. I wish I could do that, some of the food I give. In my bowl, when I look at it, and you go and get me something else. You know, you treat me worse than the dog, you guys. And so I said, look, I've got to be involved as a dog. It's a lovely life. You go run around and play all day. And I said, listen, man, the first thing which happens to you after a few weeks as a dog, you get taken to the vet for you know what. That's right, he got it. I don't want to be a doggie. But if you really want to, that's what you get if you've got the karmic wherewithal. And that's why people keep getting reborn. Because they want to. And they've got enough karma. And it's the will, it's the problem. And why do you want to be reborn? It's totally conditioned. And you think, well, maybe this life it didn't work out okay, but next life it will. Next life, I'm going to be a man in my next life. No, next life I'm going to be a woman. Now next life, I'm going to be sort of a monk. I'm going to be reborn in a Buddhist country. And I'm not going to have any marriage, so I can really be a monk in my next life. Now I want to be a rich person in my next life. Oh, I want to... All these fantasies that you have, which you want to be something, that's why you get reborn again. Because you haven't finished with this yet. And you haven't realized that any type of life you have sucks. The whole lot. So don't think, well, maybe if I was born into a wealthy family, and had all this money, and if I was really healthy, and I was handsome, and just a chick magnet in my next life, then everything will be happy and wonderful. And of course, you know, you go around, you see people who are wealthy and handsome and skilled and stuff, they still suffer a huge amount. So it's because you want to. That's why you get reborn again. So, give up that will. Well, as soon as you know it's not yours, it's much easier to let go of it. When it's yours, you will cherish that and you will never let it go. Because it's mine. What is that which makes peace, being kind, being gentle, if there isn't anyone there? Again, I've already mentioned that. I did that. So why do we bother to practice and cultivate this path where there's no one there? Because you've got no choice. You have to. Try not to. It's impossible. You've got no choice but to practice. I have two rather mundane questions, please. When I go for a brisk walk while on retreat for exercise, can I do that without disturbing the stillness of the mind I have acquired? If so, how? You walk with stillness. So this is what Ajahn Chah says, still water flowing. So it sounds a bit sort of zen. And that's why, you know, these oxymorons are always very deep, aren't they? Sometimes they mean absolutely nothing at all. But they sound interesting, so that's why people think they're wise. But what he really meant there was, it's when you're walking, you're not really going anywhere. Just the forest is passing you by. And you are still in every moment, just being here in the present moment, silent. So your mind is not going anywhere, just your body is. So you can go for a brisk walk, your mind's not going anywhere. It's always here, just your body moving. Still water flowing. When one is comfortable sitting cross-legged on the floor for meditation, either for long periods on retreat or daily meditation at home, is it a good idea or not to regularly swap legs, even though one side is usually more comfortable than the other? Yeah, you can swap legs. It's a good idea. Because it sort of, you know, balances the posture. Dear Ajahn, I, conventionally speaking, once had a very peaceful meditation. It felt very liberating. My question is, why a few months after that just didn't feel like putting effort into meditating? Because I didn't do anything to get peaceful, my practice back, and I was happy just chilling. I didn't feel like meditating. If I were to judge myself, it seems I got much more lazy in my practice, which concerns me. I didn't get that peaceful since, but I felt very relaxed and satiated afterwards. The reason why I'm asking this now is if that laziness in practice afterwards is natural, what is the cause of diligence or slack in practice? Okay, so what happened there? You got a nice meditation. okay, you got something as far as those people want a treatment. So I got something, that's fine, so I don't need to do anything anymore. But also, you weren't really looking about what meditation does. I remember in my life as a meditator, I started getting slack. I was very diligent in the first year of meditating, but the second year I just, well, there's something else to do, I do something else. I didn't meditate that much. And there was a guy I met in a coffee shop. He was a French guy, really grateful for him, because I was talking about meditation, he was a meditator. And I said, yeah, I used to do lots of meditation, but not so much these days. He said, why not? I said, well, it's just not really interesting. It's not working. And he said, it is working, but you're not noticing it. And he was the one who taught me, at the end of every meditation, I just pause and ask myself how I feel. Is there any difference there from when I started? When I did that, I thought, my goodness, every meditation had a good effect. Only some meditations weren't really, really peaceful, but they were still much better than when I started. So when I did that reflection, how do I feel towards the end of a meditation before I opened my eyes and got up? I thought, wow, actually this meditation is working. I never noticed it before. I never took the time to pause and look to see what had happened. And once I started doing that, I liked my meditation so much it just took off. So even those so-called bad meditations, you look at your mind after the end of a bad meditation, it's still more peaceful than when you began. It shows you that meditation is working. You are getting something. And that will mean you aren't lazy anymore, you just want to meditate more and more and more when you see the results. For the record, my wife is menopause. Remember that question? Agreed that she had broken the marriage contract by not wanting sex anymore, and I should not have to go without sex. So I don't think this breaks the third precept. So after all, I would never have got married if the marriage would be celibate. I don't know. That's a reasonable argument, especially if your wife said, okay, she knows everything you're doing, and she says she doesn't want sex anymore, and I should not have to go without sex. There was cases in the suttas there where there's some men, they listened to a teaching of the Buddha, they meditated, they became non-returners. I think it was Uga. And he became like a non-returner, which means you're just totally, no way can you have sex anymore. That's actually one way of knowing sort of monks and nuns to see, or lay people, just how far they've gone. It's standard that anyone who is a non-returner or an arahat, they can't sort of have sex, they can't sort of get angry anymore, they don't have lust, it's just gone forever. So he became a non-returner, so no way he could have sex. He had four wives before. Three wives. So he told his three wives, he said, look, I can't sort of be your husband anymore, so it's up to you what you want to do. If you want to sort of stay in the home and just be on eight precepts like me, fine. If you want to go back to your parents, fine. If you want another husband, I'll try and find one for you. And actually, because there was three, the three did the different things. One sort of went back home to their family, and the other one sort of wanted a husband, so he managed to find a good one for her. And the third one just wanted to stay at the home, just keeping eight precepts like he did. So that is actually similar here. If a person actually says, well, don't really want sex anymore, and they know exactly what you're doing, and they give you permission, I think maybe actually is a case there to say it's not breaking the precepts. But who am I to say? This is not the Catholic Church. Monks are not infallible like the Pope. We do not pronounce on things and say this is evil and that's okay. All a monk can do is give you advice and say, well, this might be a case there. And you find it out for yourself. So that's one of the problems and one of the beauties of Buddhism. We don't pronounce. All we do is help you make your decision. And as long as you make a wise decision, it's usually reasonably good karma. I have another one. I feel better qualified than Ajahn to answer one of last night's questions. The answer is sex a hindrance to meditation? Is no, it doesn't have to be. If done with love, integrity, mindfulness, and with the door of the heart wide open, it can be a meditation. And by the way, asking a monk questions about sex is like asking my advice about those Nimitta thingos. Okay, I won't comment on that. I know when I'm beaten. Virajan Brahman, because there is no will, and because of it's a process of cause and effect, does accountability responsibility matter? I've already answered that one. If so, who is accountable? Your process is accountable. In other words, you know, your process will suffer, your process will have happiness. Not you, but just that's what you'll feel. And responsibility is part of the process. Doesn't mean that when it comes to karma, karma vipaka, it essentially means just the unfolding of a process and there is no person to feel it or do it. Exactly. You are a process. That's why you come in to this factory and I sort of change your process and you go out from this Jhana Grove factory a changed woman, a changed man. But if the process is not complete, you have to come back next time to get another sort of processing by me. Someone some time back told me that meditation can lead to self-hypnosis. Is there any truth to this? No, hypnosis is very different than meditation. In hypnosis, you actually don't cultivate your awareness, your mindfulness. You actually relinquish your mindfulness. You don't really know what's going on in hypnosis. In meditation, your mindfulness gets stronger and more powerful. There's a huge difference there between hypnosis and self-hypnosis and meditation. Last question. Ajahn, please explain. This is strange and funny. Today I decided I'm not going to meditate. I'm taking a break. I've had it with meditation, setting up mindfulness, watching present moment, etc. I just sat enjoying my time off. I felt so good. Mind felt freer. Bliss was coming, a little brighter, etc. One of the best meditations during this retreat. At this point I sometimes fluke the letting go button. Two questions. How do you at will let go? Is it trial and error and practice? This doing nothing approach seems better than the methodical stage-by-stage approach in the basic method. How do they differ and is one better? Relaxing and keeping gentle or training in the stages. P.S. It's nice when you say sometimes. Okay, now. Uh-oh. It's P.S. My cottage neighbour sings in her room. If you want to sing, come to morning and evening chanting. Sing as much as you like then. So, okay, you decide to meditate to take a break. It's common because when people are meditating, they always tend to do things and make the meditation happen. When you took a break, you just let go. Just watch present moment, etc. Just sat enjoying my time off. It felt good, mind felt freer, bliss was coming, a little brighter, and one of the best meditations. Now, you should get some insight from that experience. When you try to meditate, it don't work. When you just enjoy the moment, you know, doing nothing, going nowhere, being no one, just being here, then with that degree of contentment, that degree of happiness in the moment, of course meditation works. But you don't have to sort of do that outside, you just do it on the seat when you're meditating, and just enjoy being here, not doing anything, just sitting in this comfortable seat, or doing it on the stoop, or do it in your room. And that's actually, you don't at will let go, because as soon as you will it, it doesn't happen. You let go of the will, you just enjoy this moment, not doing anything. This doing nothing approach seems better than a methodical stage by stage approach. That stage by stage approach is just describing what happens when you let go. That's how you reach those stages. The more you let go, the more those stages happen. So what you do is letting go. Making peace, being kind, being gentle, being patient. That's what you do. And the stages are what happened on the journey. So that's how that one works. And the last question tonight is, when the five hindrances are not abandoned, we see what we want to see. But when the five hindrances are abandoned, we see reality, the total emptiness. My meter ride, that means nothing. Please connect me if I'm wrong. Thanks. Indeed. There's a lot of times we do see what we want to see. Sometimes that even people can fluke, not fluke, they can actually imagine nimittas. They see what, if you really, 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 really want to get into jhanas, sometimes you sit here and you get a little light coming to mind. It's a nimitta. Yeah, it's a nimitta. And you get a little bit peaceful. That's jhana. And then I come and say, I'm sorry, that's not jhana. You say, Ajahn Brahm doesn't really understand. You go to another teacher. I remember this woman once, this Thai lady, and she was seeing this great monk Ajahn Tate. And I just was seeing Ajahn Tate, and he was one of these monks who's so beautiful and lovely and calm, I just wanted to sit next to him forever. And then this woman was asking, he said, you know, I got into this state, it was fourth jhana, wasn't it? Ajahn Tate said, what? And he said, oh, and I was really peaceful, it was fourth jhana. Oh, come on, no way it's at fourth jhana. But then I had this experience, and that experience, and never. I mean, he said, and then this happened, and that happened. Oh, he said, it must have been fourth jhana. Because he said, And she came out afterwards, Ajahn Tate has confirmed I've got fourth jhana. It was a classic case. She went in there, she was going to ask and ask and ask and ask until she got something. And I went, okay. He said, okay. And sometimes, this is true, that people's wishful thinking is so great that sometimes they make those things happen. Which is sometimes why the Buddha actually warned against overestimation of attainments. So it was so common, even monks sometimes would say they were enlightened. And even the Buddha couldn't convince them otherwise. Because they wanted to be enlightened so much. So be careful of wanting. It can create anything. So be careful. So it's true that when the five hindrances, there's no wanting at all. There's no ill will. That's when you're content, you're happy. It doesn't matter if you've got a jhana or not. You're just really content. And then the jhanas happen. So, five hindrances are abandoned. Then you see what's really out there, not what you want to see. That's where you got all these great insights. Because it's a wanting and not wanting which block you see truth. Sometimes people don't want to see that, you know, the people they love the most are going to die. Sometimes people don't want to think, oh, this retreat is going to be over in a few days. I don't want it to happen. Sometimes people say, come on, bring it on. I want to go home. So desire and ill will really just run people's lives. So if you can give those up, then you see the realities. Nothing there. The jewel in the heart of the lotus. It's much nicer when there's no one at home. Okay, so that's enough for this evening. So remember what I said about the most dangerous place in the world being your bed. So those of you who want to do Maranasati, the longer you stay off your bed, the less chances of dying. Never mind, just go and have a nice rest and take it easy. And just hopefully you enjoy the meditation tonight and tomorrow morning.